And with that, I would like to turn it over to the director of the Superfund Research Program, Dr. Michelle Heacock, for additional opening remarks.
Thank you, Dylan. Just a quick check to make sure you can hear me.
Coming through clear.
Thank you. So everyone, good afternoon, especially on a Friday. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy day. I hope you all had a great week. Hope we end it just right with this great webinar series. My name's Michelle Heacock. I'm the branch chief of the Hazardous Substance Research Branch, as Dylan mentioned, where I have the absolute pleasure of overseeing the Superfund Research Program with my colleagues, and you'll hear from one of them just next, Dr. Danielle Carlin. Because the Superfund Program, or SRP as we refer to it, may be new to some audience members, my colleague and I wanted just to take you through a few slides just to give you a little bit of context for our program. Next slide, please. So since 1986, SRP has provided practical scientific solutions to protect health, the environment, and communities. So the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, or NIHS, is one of the National Institutes of Health, or NIH. And SRP funds grants on basic biological, environmental and engineering processes to find real solutions to hazardous waste problems. In addition, SRP helps to train the next generation environmental health researchers. We also encourage research translation. So we call upon our grant recipients and researchers to reach beyond the university setting to partner with potential end users of their technologies. So for this reason, the research translation, we initiated the Progress in Research webinar series, which features work being initiated by recently awarded grant recipients. So the purpose of these webinars is to facilitate a dialogue between the researchers, field practitioners, and stakeholders so that the new projects are on a trajectory for successful technology transfer and application by end users. So please feel free to engage and ask questions. I invite you to check out our overview video. You see the link at the bottom left. It gives a little history of our program and work being done by some of our recipients. This and all the other links shared today are available on the slide posted on the CLUE and registration webpage. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned, SRP provides grants to universities and small businesses to solve complex environmental health problems through multidisciplinary research to reduce cleanup costs, decrease exposure to contaminants, and improve human health. The Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act established a broad mandate and a set of goals for NIHS to pursue within the SRP. And these are what you're seeing, these four boxes on the left. I'm not going to read through them, but the mandates include elements of determining health effects, assessing risk detection, and remediation of hazardous substances related to Superfund sites. In addition to these mandates, the SRP has legislation which includes establishment and support of training to include short courses and continuing education for personnel engaged in handling hazardous substances, and graduate and advanced training in environmental and occupational health and safety in the public health and engineering aspects of hazardous waste control. This is why we created the SRP R25 program, and R25 is just a grant mechanism. Next slide, please. So this is a map showing you where our across several grant mechanisms. R25 is not the only grant mechanism we support, but it gives you an idea of where we're funding research across the country, how we're doing it to meet the goals of our mandate. So this is just showing you the spread. We also wanted to highlight the R25s, and they are shown as red dots. These are the sites for occupational health and safety training education programs on emerging technologies, say that 10 times fast, who you'll be hearing from over the next three sessions in this series, and we hope you'll have the opportunity to take part in each of these sessions. So I encourage you to check out the SRP website to learn more about these grant mechanisms and upcoming SRP funding opportunities. The link's on the slide in the bottom. I just want to turn it over now to Dr. Danielle Collin, my colleague in SRP, and she's going to talk about the occupational health and safety training funding mechanism, and we'll provide an overview of the webinar series. Danielle, over to you.
Thanks so much. And I also want to do a sound check. Does that sound okay?
You do.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much, Michelle. And hello, everyone, today out in our virtual audience. I'm Danielle Carlin, and I'm a program administrator with the SRP. So I wanted to tell you a little bit more about our program, go a little bit more deeper than what Michelle was able to provide. And it's really to highlight new technologies, emerging environmental contaminants, and disasters that can create potential health hazards. So to protect workers and scientists, the SRP released a funding opportunity for occupational health and safety training education programs on emerging technologies. As Michelle mentioned, it's our R25 program. So the purpose of this general NIH R25 program is to support research education activities that complement and/or enhance the training of a workforce to meet the nation's biomedical, behavioral, and clinical research needs. It's also there to enhance the diversity of biomedical, behavioral, and clinical research workforce. Also there to help recruit individuals with specific specialty or disciplinary backgrounds to research careers in biomedical, behavioral, and clinical sciences, or also to foster a better understanding of biomedical, behavioral, and clinical research and its implications. So this is why we use the R25 mechanism for this particular program. So the latest round of grant funding, which was in 2021, led to the development of seven collaborative projects that are creating educational and training programs for industrial hygienists and scientists in the areas of emerging technologies, new environmental contaminants of concern, and disaster response. So the projects provide training in waste management, disaster preparedness and risk management, evaluation of exposures to hazardous materials in emerging fields such as nanotechnology, and the management of agents such as bacteria and viruses, just to name a few. So I think we go to the next slide. So we are again excited to have you all joining us for today's webinar. And the first in the series is titled Emerging Technologies in Occupational Health and Safety. We have two more webinars that are coming up on May 3rd and May 17th. So please register for those. And more information and links to register are available via the link on the slide. I think next slide now. So now it's my pleasure to introduce our first two speakers. We're going to be starting with New York Training Center for Emerging Technologies in Industrial Hygiene, and that's a collaboration between the City University of New York, or better known as CUNY, School of Public Health, and the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. So we're joined by Brian Pavlonis, who's an associate professor at CUNY. And then we have Dr. Homero Harari, who's an assistant professor from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. And they're going to be discussing their work facilitating training and research opportunities for industrial hygiene students in New York City. So Dr. Pavlonis and Dr. Harari, I'm going to turn it over to you. And thank you again.
Great. Thank you so much, Danielle, for the introduction. And let me just share my screen. And we can start. All right, so everything's coming through okay?
Or at least, yes, coming through clear.
Sounds good, yes, right. Yes, thanks.
Okay, so as Danielle mentioned, this is a joint endeavor between four institutions within New York City. The Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, CUNY, Queens College, and the Advanced Science Research Center, which is also located at CUNY. And Homero and myself are the co-PIs on this grant. And so far, we've had a number of trainees work on different projects that we have going. Today, I'm going to talk about the use of low-cost sensors to empower nail salon workers to their reduced exposures in the salons. So the goals of this presentation are to discuss the regulations implemented by New York State to control exposures and the scope of the overall problem, review the commercially available low-cost sensors to quantify PVOC concentrations. We're going to go through the validation procedures we use and some preliminary results. And we're going to look at some of the training sessions we've done with the nail salon workers in order to reduce their exposure in the salons. So overall, I mean, this is a fairly large problem in New York, the New York State and tri-state area. We have something like 25,000 nail salon workers in this area, and there's around 200,000 nail techs throughout the US. So it's a fairly large contingent of workers. Now, I would say, we've done a large body of research and we understand what the exposures are, and they've been fairly well characterized. And we also really know what the controls are, either substitution, elimination, and ventilation. Those all seem to work fairly well. The problem is we're not getting very good compliance, and that could stem from a number of reasons, from cost to a lack of training and education among nail salon workers. So that's kind of where we come in with this grant, providing both, technical assistance to the nail salon workers, and training sessions with them. And the overall kind of goal is, can we incorporate these low-cost sensors, something that costs around $300 into the nail salons to really help them reduce their exposures? Now, this is from a New York Times article, I think from 2015. So obviously there could be some changes. But if you look at the top left panel of this graphic, you can see nail salons in the tri-state area are big business. I mean, this is a huge contingent of workers and salons. For people that really haven't been to Manhattan a while, you can walk every block and come into a nail salon. There's nail salons in almost every block in Manhattan, 800 nail salons in Manhattan alone. And this is an important business sector for a lot of recent immigrants from Korea, China, Vietnam, and there's a fairly large contingent of Nepalese workers in these salons. Now, most of the workers have limited English language skills and employment options. So, unfortunately, if they're getting sick on the job, they don't have a lot of recourse or other, job sectors they can go into. So, if they're getting sick, they, sometimes have to remain at work. Now, the overall workplace profile shows that, nail salon workers are not making too much money. You have a median salary around $31,000, and that's for New York City. So it's fairly impoverished wages for nail tech. If you kind of think about this in a chemical by chemical exposure, yes, most nail salons do not even approach, or the exposures in the nail salons do not really approach any sort of occupational exposure limits. I think the one where you do some have some overexposure is formaldehyde. But that is, completely thinking about this exposure in a one-dimensional lens. We know these workers are exposed to this very complex mixture of just a number of different chemicals. We're not really thinking about the additive or synergistic effects of these exposures, the long hours on the job. They're working 60 hours a week. All the psychological stresses, that all can combine to produce adverse health effects. So you can see on the slide here, just the vast exposure to all these different chemical classes, anything from phthalates to different reproductive toxins to irritants, endocrine disruptors. It's a fairly large category of chemicals and chemical classes that workers are exposed to. Not to mention issues with respirable dust. You can have chemicals absorbing onto that dust and ergonomic issues. You can see, in this picture, a person is shaping a nail, excuse me, with a vibrating hand tool. Obviously, exposure to vibrating tools, awkward postures. So there's a number of different ergonomic issues as well in these salons. Now, from my perspective, we've done a lot in terms of characterizing the exposure, understanding very short-term health effects like respiratory issues, cough. But we haven't really scratched the surface yet on what are the long-term implications of working in these nail salons. When you talk to a nail salon worker, One of the first things that usually comes up is, how is this affecting my reproductive health? And, there really hasn't been too many studies looking at, reproductive health, just long-term diseases like cancer. Those really haven't been explored yet. And, I think it's really important, again, to look at exposure and hazards through a holistic lens. I think we've moved well beyond, well, they're exposed to this chemical, they're exposed to this chemical. What we need to really understand is, how do all these different stressors in their life come together to adversely affect their health? Anything from, stress at the job, from wage theft, discrimination, long hours, the chemical exposure, the ergonomic issues, lack of community support, exposure at home, all those different stressors, and how are they coming together to affect workers' health? So the next thing I'm going to talk about is this public health law that came about in New York City that has, implemented some good changes within the salon, but was very poorly designed. And this is kind of where we come in, to work with the, the nail techs to understand what this law is, how they can reduce their exposure, and how they can maybe use these low-cost tools to understand their exposure and then pair it with their ventilation system. So in 2015, there was a series of investigative reports done by the New York Times. And in these reports, it really chronicled the life and the hazards of being a New York City nail tech. And what came about from this law was a new state requirement for ventilation to be installed in the nail salons. And it was supposed to be done by, I think, 2021, but COVID kind of backed it up. So they gave salons about 7 years almost to comply with this new regulation. So it is in full effect right now. And basically, this law is a two-pronged approach. So it has a component where you need to install a local exhaust ventilation system at each one of your pedicure and manicure stations. In addition, you have to have continuous exhaust via a general exhaust ventilation. So this two-pronged approach, this was basically designed by the International Mechanical Codes and implemented in all New York state nail salons. Now, the problem with this is, in New York City, we have thousands of workers that speak just a number of different languages. So, this is, fairly complex engineering. They didn't do The New York State did not do a very good job in terms of translation services to have the nail salon owners, managers to understand this law. They also provided really no resources. There was no tax rebates. They didn't even provide basically a list of contractors that spoke the different languages of the nail salon owners to come out and give them bids. So they basically wrote this law with highly technical languages that wasn't translated properly and said, go ahead and comply with this. And that kind of ran into a lot of different issues with nail salon owners and managers understanding the law and implementing it in their salons. So prior to the law going into effect, basically we wanted to collect baseline measurements in the nail salons to understand the exposure. So this was a study done in from 2018, and we published in 2020. But the main takeaway that I want you to get from this was basically prior to the law going into effect, the small number of nail salons that we did talk to and collect exposure measurements in, for the most part, the owners and managers did not understand how their ventilation system worked. They really couldn't answer basic questions like, is your general exhaust ventilation ducted outside? Are you just recirculating the air? No one was complying with the local exhaust ventilation to this point, and most salons didn't even have a general exhaust ventilation. Okay. And these are just some baseline measurements that we collected prior to the law really going into effect. And what we found was of the compliant salons listed on the top column here, we had three. Your TVOC exposure was 3 to 4 times less than your non-compliant salons on the bottom. Interesting, what we found was that these compliant salons had much more customers and were bigger. So your bigger salons, you know, had better ventilation compared to these non-compliant salons. So I guess from a public health perspective, this did give us some indication that we maybe need to target some of these smaller salons because they may not be the ones that are complying with the regulations. Also, what we found really was there was little variability in exposure day to day. So we collected measurements over 3 days and basically it found that a salon with bad indoor air quality had bad indoor air quality for 3 days. The compliant salons had good indoor air quality over those 3 days. So, you know, it didn't seem to be much fluctuations between them. Okay, so I guess, you know, another big takeaway, at least for me, that kind of guided this research we're doing now is I really feel like salon owners and managers need tools to visualize their exposure in order to understand when they need to actually use their ventilation system and really pay more attention to what the ventilation system does, how it operates, et cetera. Okay, so that kind of led to the R25 grant and our work with the nail salon workers and owners. Basically, like I said, ventilation works. You know, I don't think that's a really huge conclusion, but it works. The law, as intended, probably would work well to reduce exposure. The problem is, like I said, salons are not complying with this. So how can we get these salons to comply? So, you know, one possibility is, you know, obviously training and showing the owners, managers, their exposures in order to help reduce them. So what we did for this study was, and the work with the nail salons was to test the validity of some commercially available low-cost sensors. We developed intervention strategies with the owners and managers to help them understand their TVOC exposures. And then finally, we looked at the overall reduction in exposures after we conducted these interventions and trainings with the nail salon owners and managers. So we partnered with one community group. They're called Adhikar, and it's a Nepalese group that is a woman-led community organization and worker center that provides direct services to the Nepali-speaking community. Now, overall, Nepalese workers in nail salons are a minority of workers. They earn less than typical nail salon workers, around $20,000. From a survey conducted by Adhikar, they make between $40 to $70 per day. And there is some worker discrimination among the Nepalese workers. So from this community group, we recruited 7 salons so far for this intervention and training strategy. 4 salons were in complete compliance with the New York state law. However, they actually weren't using their ventilation systems. 2 had a local exhaust ventilation system, but didn't really understand that they needed to install a general exhaust ventilation system as well. Another, I guess, poor aspect of the communications of New York State. And finally, 1 had no ventilation system at all. Okay, so the way that we set up this project is we found 6 low-cost sensors. Now, each sensor, you know, varied in price, but they were between $300 to $700. And what we would do is we'd go into the salon to collect baseline data measurements. We could just understand before the intervention and training, okay, what were the concentrations in the salon? So we collected those with the sensors co-located with a PID. over a 7-day period. We asked the owners, managers, don't change anything. Just work as you can't even, notice these are going on. Just write down your services, how you did the, how you use your ventilation system, but don't change anything about your daily work day. Then after 7 days, we'd collect all the equipment and we'd go back and analyze the data. And we look at, what the peak exposures are, when they were, look at the CO2 concentration. So if you could see how they were using their ventilation system. And then we'd go back and spend about an hour with the owner and manager, showing them their data, showing them basically how their ventilation system worked, and asking them to, make modifications. Anything from increasing the fan speed to just some of the salons use the ventilation system. And then we would come, set up our equipment again for another 7 days of measurements after the training, and then pick the equipment up and look at both the accuracy of the sensors, the low-cost sensors, and then also how the reduction in exposure, how much of the reduction in the exposure occurred after our training session. Now, the workplace sensors, we wanted to identify sensors that were all commercially available. So, I mean, I know, there's a lot of work being done to design these sensors, and build your own sensors, but we wanted something basically that an owner or manager could go on Amazon today and buy and just get a sensor. So these were all commercially available. The price point was between $300 to $700, depending on what kind of features they had. All of them used a metal oxide sensor. And the criteria for us selecting sensors were they had to be able to data log, be under $1,000, measure at least up to 10 parts per million, and have some sort of threshold with a warning. Now, most of these sensors actually will send warnings via like email. So it's discreet and not like setting off an alarm. But for like our interventions, even though we haven't really used it to this point, we wanted to try to set a threshold so we could send warnings when to turn the ventilation system on. I don't really need to go into that in the interest of time. So let me give you some preliminary results. Now, I understand, there's a lot more data we need to collect and much greater analysis that we need to do. But the first two sensors we bought and we implemented in the salons were an aware sensor, that's the top left, and a Katerra sensor. You could see we collected a substantial number of time points. So we had 17,000 5-minute measurements for one sensor and 22,000 for another. Now, each had, I would say a good correlation with your PID sensor, which is our high cost, high accuracy sensor, around 0.6. However, there was a large mean absolute error between the sensors. And somewhat problematically, we are seeing that there is some degradation in the accuracy of the sensors over time. So on both the aware, you can see at least one of the sensors, the mean absolute error is increasing with time. And the Katerra as well. And you're getting, almost a 20 part per million error in these sensors. And the mean absolute error increases substantially with your actually, your true concentration in the salon. So as, the concentration of PVOCs increase in the nail salons, your mean absolute error increases as well. And this is somewhat problematic if you're trying to establish a threshold to warn the nail salons, like turn on the ventilation system, because you need to adjust, what that threshold's going to be based upon the mean absolute error. These other two sensors that we've purchased recently, these are you can go on Amazon right now and buy these. There's the Yoohoo Smart Air Monitor. And the AirThings View Plus, all go on Amazon and you can purchase these. These cost around $250 to $400. Again, we're getting a good correlation with the true reference standards in the nail salon. A little bit higher mean absolute error compared to the previous two sensors. And again, you're seeing that absolute error increase substantially as concentration increases. I mean, that is somewhat expected. These sensors were developed and calibrated for indoor air quality in homes, not necessarily nail salons, which have much higher concentration. But again, for trying to establish like a threshold for warning, when your air, kind of jumps all over the map, it's somewhat problematic to do that. Now, the two newest sensors that we've been began testing are from a company called Atmo, and these seem to be the most promising. Now, these are designed more for research purposes, and if you go to their website, they have a number of research collaborations, and you could see, the correlation much better, 0.98, 0.90. Again, we've only used these for a few salons so far, so we're still looking at what the agreement is between the true validated sensors. But we are showing more promise with this brand, and we're going to try to maybe implement these in further studies. Now, for the other component of this grant, and something I'm most interested in is working with the nail salons and doing the training sessions. So you can see a picture of me at one of the nail salons with a student that is on the grant as well, that is doing and conducting a training session with the owner here. So again, after we take these baseline measurements, we put together a whole report, and then we go back to the salon and we show them their exposure readings, and just come up with a simple strategy. Anything from, again, turning on the ventilation system, maybe opening doors, just anything to try to get some air movement in the salon, based upon, what we're seeing at the baseline measurements. And you can see that, these training sessions, granted, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen a year out from these training sessions, or if there's, going to stick with it. But you can see the baseline measurements here. This is just for the four salons that we've collected both baseline and intervention with. You can see you do get a substantial reduction in PVOC exposure in the nail salons. Anything between a 70 to a 30% reduction overall concentrations. Again, this is just showing our different sensors. And while they may underestimate the overall magnitude of the true concentration in there, they do seem to correlate fairly well. So as long as we can collect more data and make adjustments for these, we think that these sensors can be deployed to nail salons at a greater volume and, pair this with, some sort of threshold to warn the nail salons of when they need to turn on their ventilation or open doors, et cetera. So, in conclusion, look, we know ventilation works, okay, but the compliance isn't there. So, how do we get nail salon owners and managers to comply? And, we do see promise with these low-cost sensors, doing simple training with the owners and managers, showing them their exposures and trying to develop some sort of threshold of when, to tie a TVOC concentration to use of their ventilation system. Now, this isn't without barriers. Again, the accuracy varies by concentration. These aren't calibrated. So what happens when it malfunctions? An owner or manager wouldn't know. And also, the onboarding of these sensors can be challenging. They're not the easiest to tie to the internet, and that's how they work with a cloud setting. So again, in terms of getting owners and managers to use these, it could be tricky, especially with some language barriers. Just some other work that we're conducting at the center. At CUNY SPH, we developed an entire new course that really trained our students in both laboratory technology. They actually went to the ASRC, learned GCMS, and other types of quantitative exposure measurements, in addition to the low-cost sensors. Dr. Homero Harari, who's the co-lead on this grant, has done a ton of work with Latinx day laborers and his partner at the Labor Institute. So there's been tremendous work and outreach in that area. And just last week, we convened a conference at Mount Sinai about emerging technologies in occupational health, attended by both academics, individuals at the NIHS, and community members. So it was a great conference. Of course, I want to thank the support from NIHS, ADAKAR and Mekong, which are two community groups, and all the student researchers that have been working on this project. So I can open up for questions.
Thank you so much, Brian and Homero. That was really great. So I think we're waiting for some questions to come in to the Q&A. So I know we have a couple of questions that we've sort of, posed before the webinar, but I actually did have a kind of a selfish question. I was wondering if, nail salons don't exist just in New York. I mean, they exist all over the country, and I was wondering what kind of outreach have you all been doing maybe with other states, and how does like sort of the ventilation laws maybe differ in other states?
Just in terms of the ventilation laws, there are some in different states. Off the top of my head, California, Boston, Massachusetts, the locality, Boston has one. I saw one in DC, and Minnesota has one as well. They're all somewhat the same and based on the International Mechanical Code. I haven't done much outreach to other states. We're just trying to focus right now on New York City and kind of developing the methods. Hopefully, we're going to be publishing papers soon that will obviously get this data out there. But right now, we've been focused mainly on the New York State and New York City area.
Great,
Um,
thanks.
so I,
Yeah. So maybe, yeah, I think it, go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
oh, no, no. I do. Do you want me to read the question to the audience, or is
I'm happy to read it. Maybe that's the so the question is how the non-compliant nail salons get permit for the business in those areas? What type of health hazard those nail technicians are suffering from? I think they mentioned from the VOC exposure. And was the occupational health-based model established before collecting the data?
So in terms of the permits, I don't really know how that all works. Basically, a nail salon by, well, now has to submit permits that, they've installed the ventilation system, especially if they're trying to get a new license. The problem is, though, what we found is they're not turning on the ventilation system. So they can install it and get, clearance there, but they're not using it. And they're not using it for a number of different reasons. It's too noisy. I can't talk to customers. It's too much money. I'm not going to run it all day. I'm not going to exhaust, air conditioned air directly outside. I'll lose my business. So just because they have it doesn't mean they're using it. That's what we found. So that's where we're really trying to do this training with the nail salons. There's 2,000. Obviously, we don't have the time, energy, or money to train 2,000 nail salons how to use it. So we want to try to maybe develop a model, work with our community partners to advance this outreach. But without state support, it's going to be difficult. In terms of the health effects, like I said, I don't think we've really scratched the surface on long-term health effects from this. There's been a lot of papers published about, after leaving work, my respiratory symptoms go away. But, when I'm talking to the nail salon techs, the major concern is reproductive health effects, and I haven't seen those studies.
And if I could add to that, and that's something that we have been doing in parallel with the work with Brian and the work that we do with Latinx workers, is we provide all this information with different sensors. But what about the occupational health care? And in New York, we're very fortunate to have the Occupational Health Clinic Network, and Mount Sinai is one of the clinics. So we have been working really hard to make sure that as part of the training, workers know where they can receive occupational health support. And at the same time, connect that to primary care doctors. right? Because it is important that they know where they can receive specialized help. And this is something that we have been doing as well. So the project has been really helpful for us to reach out to communities, but also how to address their main concerns. And we are also looking into that, even though this is not, it's not the main focus, but it's important because our work is so ingrained in the community that those are really the questions that that they have. So thank you.
We did receive another, I think this is more of a comment, but feel free to respond. Is there no way the county government regulates this process during the issuing and renewal of a permit?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done too much, I guess, research about like the permitting and all that. I could say that there's not a lot of capacity for this. I mean, again, 2,000 nail salons. Are they going to go into every nail salon? You know, are you using your ventilation? Are they going to check? I mean, I think it's difficult to try to look at that. I can say just again from my own outreach, most of the salons are not using the ventilation as intended for the reasons I talked about.
And again, I encourage you all to continue putting in questions. Let's see. And then some of the other questions we had talked about a little bit before this. You know, I think it's interesting you mentioned some of the trainees that you've had involved. How many have you had, and what kinds of anecdotal experiences have they provided you? Like, what do you feel like they've gotten out of being involved with the actual nail salon workers and learning how to communicate, especially if there's such a language barrier as well?
Yeah, so we've had a number of different trainees work on this project, and they've all kind of approached the problem, you know, from their own, I guess, background of, you know, from their technical expertise. So, like, I have one student that's coming from like a biostatistics background, so she had never worked in occupational health or didn't know anything about it. So I think that was, you know, a great thing about the R25 mechanism, because it's training people on something new that they haven't done before. So, you know, one thing with these sensors and all that is the in just immense amount of data. So we're collecting 1 to 5 minute measurements over 7 days with an intervention in there, you know, from almost 10 salons. So you're getting millions and millions of lines of data from all the different sensors, because they do PM, TBOCs, et cetera. So, you know, that's been great, you know, working with someone that can understand big data and learning this whole perspective on how to use this data for bettering people's health and doing training sessions. And then we have other people, Roma, who is listed here below. She's actually from Nepal. She's been working on this project with us, doing the translation and outreach. Samantha Fisher, she's doing a lot of the work with recruitment, and she's actually going to start looking from a qualitative lens, understanding, you know, how sensors and the, you know, the occupational health issues that nail salon workers are encountering, so we can better provide training to them. So far, I think we've had 6 or 7 trainees working on this grant. And like I said, it's been wonderful to have all the students working on this and, you know, providing their own perspective and just learning just a brand new skill and doing all the outreach and communication with the nail salons workers.
Well, thank you so much, Brian and Jamero. This is really interesting work you all are doing. And for the sake of time, we are going to switch over to our next speaker. And so now it's my privilege to introduce Dr. Candace Tsai. And so we have, she leads the Occupational and Environmental Exposures and Work Practices for Nanomaterials and Electronic Products. And it's a collaboration across the Southern California region. And Dr. Tsai, she's an assistant professor in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences at the University of California, Los Angeles, and the director of the Southern California Super. She's going to be discussing some of their training programs as well. So, Dr. Tsai, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you.
Thank you for the introduction, and it's my pleasure to give the seminar an update about our program here. So today I'm going to talk about the summary and overview of our program R25 founded by Superfund Research, research program, and also I will give some highlight of our research project. So here our team consists of multiple collaborators that also include the collaborating institution at University of California, Irvine, and California State University at Fullerton, and an individual consultant to take care of our virtual reality training project. And myself is the PI of this R25 grant, working with our collaborator on campus at UCLA, Dr. Kuhi, Dr. Zhu, and Dr. Shah. We are centered at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences. And our goal of this entire program is to train our students and industrial professionals. We will develop a modern and multidisciplinary training program for all of them and the community of industrial hygienists. And it will help them to prepare them to be a next generation professionals for effective management of the occupational stressors, which is caused by the emerging technology, emerging materials, such as nanomaterial and an electronic product. So our team is not just collaborate with the other campus under the UC system, but also we have internal partnership with the Southern California ERC Center founded by US NIOSH. So through the partnership, we provide the training programs to industrial hygiene students, and we offer the continuing education courses to industrial participants to learn from our training material in this program. And within our program, we partner together to provide opportunity for graduate students to receive the research training on the five different topics as listed over here. And we have special expertise within our team members. All the investigators involved, we have expertise range from the public health, industrial hygiene engineering, toxicology, community health, and the virtual reality. So we are able to address all the different topics and give the trainee the opportunity to learn, and including industrial professional. And in addition to that, I also would like to emphasize that we provide a multidisciplinary training program to those participants, especially students that we engage and recruit very diverse population of students and give them the opportunity to learn the leadership skill through our leadership activity, invited well-known leaders to share the experience, and we train students to stand out of group doing the research as a leader and present in the professional conference. So let's move on to give some update regarding our program's outcome. So here are the data to present what we have done so far regarding the training to the graduate student, undergraduate student, and industrial professionals. So the table below here, you can see that I list out, this is a 5-year R25 training program. We are currently on the third year. So the data is showing you within the third year period starting from 2021. And we have a few doctoral students as a trainee. And by this coming year, we are going to fill in the maximum number of the doctoral student trainee in our program. We're going to have 3 doctoral students in this coming year total. And we, in the past year, including this coming year, we have about 4 or 5 master student trainees being involved. and very similar number, like 4 to 5 undergraduate students coming into our summer workshop program. And all the master and doctoral students, they are all industrial hygiene students. And starting that last year, we began to have industrial participants. They are industrial hygienists or environmental health and safety professional join our workshop to receive the training. And in this program, we also offer a new course in the academic year that has been developed and offered from the second year, which is the course entitled as Nanomaterial Related Emerging Technologies for Exposure and Health Effect. The last item I want to emphasize is our diverse population of trainees. So those trainee students coming into our program from the first year, it includes about 50% of underrepresented minority students. And this population, the underrepresented minority students increased to 75% in the second year. We expect this coming year will have a pretty similar percentage of the diverse student population. All right, the next outcome I also would like to present is regarding our performance. So we hire a third party of evaluator to evaluate our program performance. So each year they conduct a survey on those participants prior to participating in the program and after participating in this program. So here is the data. You can see that we survey the question regarding their understanding with all type of topic that we provide the training to them. And before they participate into the program, you can see most of them has very limited knowledge regarding the content that we deliver to them and provide the opportunity for them to learn. And then after the program participation, you can see that there is significant change, move from very limited knowledge or no knowledge at all to the very knowledgeable and extremely knowledgeable from those topics that we introduce to them through the workshop, through the summer research program, and the academic 9 months program training. Okay, then next item I also would like to present is regarding our product. So in terms of product we produce from this program, all our trainees, they are pretty productive. Like within the 3 years period, those graduate student trainees, including master and doctoral students, they have published 4 papers. And there is a one that's going to be published soon and at under very high impact journal, Journal of Clinical Production. All the others are range from a pretty nice journal from the Public Health and the Chemical Health and Safety of ACS Journal. In addition to the paper published through their research training and the research project, they also present in the professional scientific conferences. Then the students have presented 9 conference presentations, and they range from industrial hygiene conference, nano conference, and international conference, and the chemical engineering conference. There's a live presentation throughout the 5 different conferences. And not just the students are productive and doing research, engage into that. Our program also provide a training for students to become very independent and take the leadership on their research project. And then they have established that not just do the presentation and publish, they are all the first author. I want to show the list up here, all the 4 publications here that the students who take the lead on the project and also being the first author for the presentation and the publication. So this is the list of the trainee, the master and doctoral students who published the paper in the past 3 years. And these are the list of the conference presentation that all these trainees, they present as a first author on the oral presentation on podium. Okay. So the next part of the presentation that I'm going to address is the research highlights. So as you see that we have quite many, probably about a dozen of graduate students involved in the past and have been engaged, involved actively in doing the research training relevant to emerging technology and materials. So the first research highlight I would like to talk about that is through our collaborating institute at the UC Irvine. So this doctoral student, Mary Yang, under the supervision of myself and Professor Daly at UCI, she has a strong interest into the electronic waste. And her research is doing to navigate and investigate the sustainable resource recovery from electronic waste through the cryo-melting process. And why electronic waste? So we know all the electronic product we are using now, whenever we replace the old one by a new one, the old product, electronic product will land into the recycling facility. And in the recycling facility accumulated with so many electronic waste. And for example, this circuit board is shown here. So like circuit board include many components, and the majority of them are either the metal component or the plastic resin, which are the polymer. And also there's a lot of chemical included in those electronic waste, such as the PFAS. So our interest is looking into the first project that we have involved is we engage and collaborate with the electronic waste recycling facility. So the Maria student Maria actually went to the electronic waste facility to collect those waste printed circuit board. She has many of that, few dozen of those collected. And she looked into the issue regarding the electronic waste, use the circuit board as the first product to look into it. So why circuit board? Circuit board has a lot of heavy metal that being coated. They are toxic and can expose to the workers during the recycling process in the electronic recycling facility. And not just that, from this process to recycle this electronic circuit board, we also lose a lot of very important metal. There are many special and precious in as well as rare earth element are included in those electronic waste circuit board. However, many of those metals can be lost through the process and very difficult to recover them. So these are the very important topic that we are looking into it to see whether we are able to minimize, reduce the work exposure through handling and recycling electronic waste, but also we can recover as much as possible from those very important special metals. So the student Maria looked into the current challenge and existing recycling process. And here are the typical processes currently available to recycle electronic waste and to recover critical metals from the electronic waste. And we can see that all of these type of methods is shown with various type of issue. And many of them, they also release toxic substance. PFAS heavy metal into the air, into the soil, in the water through the recycling process. And some of them emit a greenhouse gas, a VOC. And not just that, they generate a high amount of toxic waste through the process. And the energy consumption is very high. Some of them use high energy process and the operation cost is high. And the most important is the efficiency to recover those heavy metal or rare metal are very low. So that the conclusion are is that all these processes, they are not sustainable. So then the solution of this is we come up with another different approach for the electronic waste recycling is to use cryo-melt. So why we use cryo-melting? The cryo-melting is using the mechanical force to grind the the waste down to the very small particles. So those circuit board will be chopped to the very small pieces and further grinded into a very small nano-sized pieces of the particles. And then this process use less energy and it's enclosed process, which minimize any emission or exposure to workers from the operation process. And not just that, when we break down to the very tiny nano-sized powders, and these powders are very easily can be separated using sedimentation in the DI water. So we can easily separate them with less energy and less cost of operation. And the efficiency to recover those metals from this process is much higher than the other traditional method. So the first part of this project has been published last year, as presented here. And the first part of research, we conclude that this cryo milling process applied to electronic waste recycling can significantly reduce, eliminate the very harmful and hazardous substance associated with this process. And it does enhance the industrial feasibility. It's easy to operate and it's a standalone process. And it removed the potential worker exposure to those substances. And it's very important, it maximized the recovery efficiency, especially those very important metal element in this electronic waste. So here I want to mention that this part of research has been presented in multiple talk and published, and we acknowledge the financial support from Superfund research program. And this is the Marian, the doctoral student, contribute to this program, and his advisor, my collaborator at the UCI, Professor Daly. Okay, now let's move on to a few other research highlight I also would like to talk about. So the next research highlight is regarding the emerging green solvent. So this is conducted by a doctoral student at the UCLA program. She has a very strong interest into the we call her emerging green solvent in the dry cleaning industry. So as we know, dry cleaning has been using many toxic solvent, which are carcinogens. So Emma, the first part of her doctoral research program, the research project is to look into a scoping review, surveyed all these possible solvent being used in the dry cleaning industry. And then she found that the result had been published last year, and then she found that many of those called emerging green solvent as alternative to those traditional toxic solvent chemical being used for the dry cleaning. But however, there's no data at all to show whether they are really safe. They couldn't find any health effect data or any information regarding this. So then she conducted her second part of research is to use epithelial human lung to be solved. This is the ongoing project right now, and this is preliminary data that she found. Those are called the green solvent alternative to those toxic human carcinogen. She found a very similar trend of the biological response based on the inflammatory response, cell viability so far. They are not as safe as promoted in this market. And so we are looking into that in more detail to look into their carcinogenicity based on those very popular green solvent being used in the industry. All right, so then next project I also want to mention about that is regarding the plastic. So this is about the nanoparticle exposure assessment that we look into that. We have multiple master students work together. They try to look into the recycling of those plastics. So we went into the recycling center and they collect the plastic waste from there. The first project we're looking into is to find out the potential exposure and emission And the physical chemical characteristic regarding those airborne released micro nanoplastic generated from the plastic shredding process. So because the plastic shredding is the very first step of the recycling of plastic, which our workers need to operate. So we get the commercial scale of industry shredder, the picture here, and we simulate the same type of the plastic shredding process as the worker would operate in the recycling facility. And they can see that after shredding of using this industrial shredder, you can see the particle of they become like a small piece of the plastic. And then we evaluate emission from the process, and we collaborate with another local company to further grind it and mill them to a very fine dust. So very fine dust for us is we want to look into the potential health effect on those substances that have been emitted out from this entire recycling process. So let's quickly look at some of the data. So in this project, we come up with two type of plastic. That one type of plastic is we collected from the recycling facility, so we call the waste plastics. Then the other group of plastic product we call the clean plastic. We can maybe call that as a new plastic. These are the same type of plastic. There's three type of plastic that we collect. Then so we find we go to look for the exact the same type of plastic, but we purchase a new one and they are clean, and we only purchase the clean, transparent type of plastic or the plastic with only white color. So the waste plastic contain multiple different type of color, which we has the different additive into it. So when we shred them, we notice the big differences between these two group of plastic. So those are clean and a new one with only a clear or white color come up with much lower emission through this shredding process. But those plastic we collected from the recycling waste facility, we wash them, we clean them very well, but when we shred them, and those contain all kind of different color for different application, and you can see the concentration is way much higher from this operation process. And not just the very high level of concentration, especially for the particles below 500 nanometer, they are submicrometer sized particle. They are pretty small, and then they are very small. Using the we have two different type of instrument to measure the particle size, range from 10 nanometer to up to 10 micrometer, and we found most of the emission from this process particle emitted out during this entire process is less than about 5 micrometers in size. So they are very small, and many of them are even in the nano size range. Not just being size very small, and the shape is very interesting. So these are the particles that we collect. On the left side, they are airborne particles collected on the filter using my invented the nanoparticle sampler. You can see those particles. Some of them are tiny, like nano size particle, this one, and many of them are respirable size particles. And compared to the right group of the particles here, those are the very fine dust that we collected. They are the residual on the shredders. So we collect them to look at them. And you can see the morphology and pretty similar, but definitely they are much larger. So they are the dust we actually collect from the machine. And not just that, I want to show you how small they could be. Those are the same sample that as I show you here, the collected on the filter, and also we collect simultaneously on the TM grid. And you can see how small they are, all different type of morphology of a particle being collected as airborne in this process. And so we look into those collected particles and analyze their elemental composition. And I want to emphasize and for you to focus on these two bar data here. So left is the plastic collected from the recycling facility. Right side is the new one we purchased. And you can see the carbon and oxygen are the primary element from polymer, which is the plastic. And those colorful bars here represent those metal components that we analyze. And these are coming from the additives. So many of them are engineered nanoparticles added into the plastic as additive to add to enhance the strength of the plastic or add a color. So you can see the big differences between these two groups. And just the last highlight, we give student training regarding the virtual reality technology. So we have students to learn about how to use VR tools to develop the training program. So we developed this to target to train the firefighter to understand how the air pollutant can be significant from the wildfire smoke. We incorporate the audio tool with the video, and then we plug in, incorporate the smoke particles, particularly into this simulation, so the firefighter can visually observe the particles, understand the level of exposure. Just the last two slides. Another project that I have presented in the past is about 3D printing. We found the nylon powder 3D printer come up with a very fine particulate in the powder and also in the airborne substance. And they can be free particles released from the 3D printed product. And you can see very tiny particles being collected airborne. So that's the end of the presentation. And I appreciate all the support from the Superfund Research Program. And here are our students participating in the workshop, visiting California Nanosystems Institute at UCLA and the class that we provided during the summer. Thank you very much. And I welcome any question you may have.
Thank you so much, Candace. That was a wonderful presentation with so much interesting work that you all are doing. So again, we do encourage those of you that are tuned in to please put your questions in the Q&A box, and we'll keep monitoring those. But I guess I'll just go ahead and it looks like we got a question. I'll make sure we use the time for that. So several toxic materials along with rare earth minerals are present within the PCBs. These PCB industries are regulated by the TSCA of EPA. Did you collect any worker health impact data at the PCB sector? What is your expected metal recovery from the cryogenic milling process? And then did you perform any air quality parameter studies, PM2.5 or PM0.5, in that plastic shredding environment?
Okay, yeah, it's a great question. So that's addressed. I think there's multiple questions here. So the first question is regarding the PCB and the worker health effect impact data. So okay, so Marion's project on the electronic waste research project, she's the third year doctoral student, and she just finished the first part of research project looking into the recycling process. So she does is going to collect those information in the future, but we do not have the data yet. And she also is going to use the in vitro cell model to look into the biological response from that. So the worker part of the data, we are planning on doing that. But I don't know how far we are able to engage the workers to collect those kind of information or through any published available data. Well, I will need to study, I will need to discuss with Marion more detail about that. And the cryomilling process regarding the metal recovery, yes, that is another objective. We are going to look into that. So, the stage of that is we know based on the current stage, we know the emission coming out from the cryomilling is limited. And so we are going to actually collect the actual data to analyze the level of emission to workers from cryomilling process. And then next is to look into the metal recovery efficiency. Theoretically, it's very high, but we are going to present actual data down the road on this project. Then the last question regarding the air quality. Yes, we do collect the, that's why I'm showing the graph of the concentration in terms of the particle number concentration. So that represents the PM 0.5, that because that's the less than 500 nanometers. So the data we present that is the number concentration of the PM 0.5. We do collect the gravimetric sampling for the mass concentration, but I can tell you it's all not detectable. It's so low. The mass concentration is very low. But also because we do the threading about like half hour time period. So if we do the threading, like the worker do the threading for like 8 hours time period, then the concentration might be detectable. I hope that answered the questions.
Thank you so much, Candace. So I guess I'm going to ask you a little bit more about the virtual reality. Have you been able to utilize that as a tool for maybe some of the other contaminants that you're interested in, for example, like the electronic waste or some of the like nano work that you're doing, or is it just right now just geared towards firefighters?
Yeah, so this project right now is we started last year. We have student interest in that. So provide training. This one is focused on air pollutant. So the we try to simulate is for the nanoparticle exposure because nanoparticle is not visible. So we try to use simulation to emphasize how it will feel like, kind of make the nanoparticle become visible to the workers. And we use firefighter as a scenario because this firefighter has difficult time to really see those kind of exposure in that actual environment. And we cannot really create a wildfire to do that. So this example. So we would like to move forward, apply the virtual reality to the other type of scenario, like you mentioned the electronic waste, the recycling environment. That might be another nice project that we can work on.
Great, thank you. I think just one final question, maybe similar to what I asked the previous two speakers, you know, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what the trainees from your group, I mean, what kind of positive or even maybe not so positive experience, like, you know, what are their thoughts about the training that they've undergone?
Yeah, so I do include the data in the table here. So we are very lucky. We have quite many trainees involved in the program. And you can see that the survey showing that, yeah, we do have a lot of data from our survey. I'm not able to include all of them here. Yeah, some of the survey does include those questions. And yes, and students are pretty satisfied. I can present those next time if we need that. And they are pretty satisfied from this program. And some of them, they emphasize they learn a lot from our program in the summer workshop. So we provide 1 week summer workshop and the 10 week summer research project. And both doctoral and master students, they participate in the summer 10 week workshop. And doctoral student will be the entire year training. And those undergraduate, especially the undergraduate students. So I get a very positive and a lot of feedback from the undergraduate student because they have never learned anything about that. They come from different major in undergraduate and then they are very excited to learn. And then many of them are come into the graduate program and the EHS major. So I'm very happy to see that.
That's wonderful. So in the sake of time, we will need to go on to our last but not least final speaker. But thank you again, Candace, for that. And then again, I also encourage you all, if you have more questions for our previous speakers, feel free to put those in the Q&A. So now we're going to hear from Dr. Ellen Wells. She's an associate professor and the director of the Occupational Environmental Health Science Programs at Purdue University. And she's going to be discussing the distance education and training on emerging contaminants and technologies, better known as the DETECT project. So Dr. Wells, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Wonderful. Thank you. Can everybody see my screen now?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
And I can hear you too.
Oh, wonderful. That's also good. All right. So I want to first thank everyone for inviting me to present at this webinar and also for the Superfund program for providing the funding through the R25 project to make this whole project possible. So without further ado, I'm going to talk about our DETECT project, which is called Distance Education and Training on Emerging Contaminants and Technologies. Talk about what the scope of the project is, what we've done so far, some of the goals for the future, and hopefully spend some quality time showing you kind of demonstrations of some of the products that we've already produced. All right, so the goal of our project to DETECT is to create education materials and provide research experiences related to three main categories: emerging contaminants, emerging technologies, and safety management systems. And so, similar to the other projects that you already heard from, this is a collaboration of several different institutions. And so this is a collaboration between faculty at Purdue, where I am located, but also at the University of Toledo and the University of South Florida, and particularly their ERC program there. And we had a couple goals in thinking about putting this together, which I'd like to highlight at this point. Is one of the things when we put the project together was that we were just coming out of COVID, and that was a period when all of us and probably many of you in the audience had to suddenly shift to online training, distance training, all of these formats that we were not entirely familiar with at the time. So around that time, we were thinking of putting this project together. So we came up with the idea of calling it distance education and training as an emphasis to really emphasize how can we use those online tools for education, but use them really effectively and take advantage of the formats and opportunities available with the online format versus in-person format to further training along. So that is really a running theme throughout all of this. We are doing in-person and research-based projects as well, but we were really inspired to create online coursework, coming out of COVID, based on learning how to use that modality in a better way, and also thinking that that modality of online training or distance education is ultimately going to be in the long run a potential vehicle for getting the information out to a larger variety of people. So that really relates to this first bullet point that I talked about here. And our target audience is really industrial hygienists, industrial hygiene professionals, and graduate students. We're also targeting undergraduate students as well, even though they're not listed on the slide, but we also have materials for them. And moving on, so we have three types of products that we are producing with this project. The first is online courses. And so we're doing three online courses, one for each project theme that I talked about. And I'll speak a little bit more about them in a moment. But these are going to be freely available online for anyone who wants to access them. In addition to the online courses, we are producing a variety of online laboratories. And I have virtual reality in parentheses here. The concentration is on online laboratories, but we're leaving the option open to turn at least one of them, but potentially several of them, into virtual reality laboratories. So the difference between online and virtual reality laboratories is that with virtual reality, you'd have to have a headset and all that equipment to engage with the laboratory. But with the online version, all you would need is a link to the internet and a computer screen. So we're going to create several laboratories that are all available online, and then several of them can be also accessed with a virtual reality equipment as well, which is a little bit more expensive to put together, which is why we have smaller number that are going to be switched over to virtual reality. And then we have in-person experiences, so kind of research experiences and more educational components as well. So moving on to the online courses, I mentioned already that we are planning three different online courses. The first is focused on emerging contaminants, the second on emerging technologies, and the third on safety management systems. And so part of this is really interesting in that in putting this together, my collaborators and I really wanted to take advantage of the broad range of knowledge from faculty and other researchers from all of the institutions, from Toledo, Purdue, and the University of South Florida, because we have a broad range of expertise and knowledge to share with everyone. So these three courses actually encompass a broad range of contaminants, technologies, and topics within safety from instructors spanning those three universities in each one. So I'll show you more about the emerging contaminants course in a moment, but it covers things from PFAS to algal blooms to emerging issues with photovoltaics and so on. So there's a lot of different components of all of this that are underpinning this. So I'm really talking in this particular lecture, I'm talking about the structure underpinning it all, but the actual content and information that we're passing on is in addition to all of that. So we partnered with Purdue Online, which I should say is a different organization than Purdue Global, for those of you who are aware of that. But Purdue Online is the local program that produces online educational content. And so we're making our courses freely available to anyone who wants to sign up for an account with Purdue Online. They're able to register and access our courses. These are asynchronous or self-paced courses so that individuals can go through and do them on their own pace. And we really designed them in collaboration with educational designers from Purdue Online who really emphasized having multiple short lessons in these online courses. So this was a shift from the traditional teaching style that I'd say most faculty have been used to over the past several decades, and that in switching to online, instead of just lecturing for an hour, we really made an effort to shorten lessons, make them more interactive, and bring them all together in an engaging standpoint so that this online class is really engaging and interesting for everyone who wants to go and take it. Right? And so interactive components again there, bottom. Interactive components, short lessons, topics, interaction. As much interaction as we can get with an asynchronous self-paced course is what we were going for. All right, so moving on to talk a little bit about the online laboratory component of our project. We have four different online laboratories planned. First two are on bioaerosol assessment and then industrial hygiene assessment using safety cabinets. And both of these two are well underway, and I will share you some images and early results from them. And then we also have laboratories on noise and ergonomic assessments that are planned to get started in the upcoming years of the project. And so, as I said earlier, all of them are going to be online. We will transfer some of them that are the best suitable to be transferred into virtual reality into that format. And all of these online laboratories will be available as standalone projects, where they'll all get their own website that we will circulate the information about, and that anyone can access the website and then complete the laboratory. But we'll also embed them as relevant into our online courses once they're completed, so that when one goes through the online course, there'll be interactive course material to go through and then an online laboratory to complete as part of working on that course. Right. So the in-person experiences. So this has changed a little bit since the start of the program largely in response to changing economic realities that we're dealing with in the U.S., namely inflation on training and doing programs. So what our goal is now is to really focus on information and research training related to interactive professional development sessions and interactive webinars. And so what we are doing is leveraging the expertise of the large number of faculty from the three different universities who've contributed to the program over time and encourage them and help them produce these professional development sessions and webinars and on topics that we're including in the online courses. So at the moment, we are developing and implementing professional development sessions related to emerging contaminants. And then we will move on with more topics related to emerging technologies and safety systems as we continue to progress through the project. And another in-person experience that we're working on are in-person demonstrations of the online laboratories. So all of the universities that we work with, we engage with the industrial hygiene professional community at a number of levels through the national meeting, but also through local chapters and local organizations and things like that. So one of the ways to distribute this experience as broadly as possible is that when the online laboratories and especially the virtual reality versions of these are completed, we'll have events at our local universities where we invite local IH professionals to come in and try out the online lab or try out a virtual reality version of the online lab and get some experience with that and those modalities as a different way for presenting and disseminating training within this field. Okay, so moving on to progress, the Emerging Contaminants online course is fully available, and I will show that to you in a moment. And at the moment, we're making progress in developing material for a second course on emerging technologies. As I mentioned earlier, we have two online labs in progress. We'll be on track to start work on the third one at the beginning of next year. And we have organized four different professional development courses that will be given at the big industrial hygiene meeting, AHA Connect, which is just next month. So we have a professional development course that will talk about research experiences, and education related to various emerging contaminant issues, including bioaerosols, hazardous algal blooms, PFAS, and noise considered emerging issues related to noise and ototoxicants. So we're very excited about that and putting the final touches on doing that, because this is just about a month away that we're going to be giving all these professional development trainings. Right. And so at this point, I'm going to show you some of the work that we've done. Also, I'll stop sharing my presentations and start sharing a different screen here. I'll just share this one. All right, so can everyone see the new screen now?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, uh-huh.
Thank you for verifying that. So this is the view of what our first online course looks like from the student perspective. So this is put together and offered via Purdue's Learning Management Systems, or LMS, which is currently Brightspace. I've learned more than I thought I would ever learn about learning management systems in the past couple of years, how they're different and how they're the same. But this is the one that we're using. So you can see, this is just the opening page for it, welcoming one to the class. If you click on the content site, there's a little introduction, and this refers to the seven different modules of basically seven different major topics that we're covering in this emerging contaminants section, which were just a general introduction to what emerging contaminants are. Sections on nanoparticles, sections on PFAS, sections on photovoltaics, harmful algal blooms, ototoxicants, and bioaerosols. We've included learning objectives and information on how to begin. And then on the side here, there's navigational aspects so that you can go to the introductory session. And with this, we would log into what the project really does look like. So this is created, like I said, to be interactive, and we would start the activity. So in this particular lesson, we start out with a very short video. In terms of making this engaging and interactive, we really limited any videos that we have in here to being very, very short. And one of the things I'm excited about with this format too is we potentially have the opportunity to add in animation to describe some processes or things like that. We haven't added animation quite yet, but that's an option. And so if you continue, then you see the lesson goes on with information and health effects as you go on. There are interactive sections on here where you see information, then you have to click on the different tabs to see more information. Again, clicking on different tabs to see aspects of this, pictures floating in. These are accordion menus. I have learned that you can have different topics in different types of menus and use the accordion function to present information about them. Additional resources. So I have links out to more information. I'm going to skip over here to the knowledge check. So at the end of each section, also, we have a little quiz to make sure people are absorbing the material that we're getting into. And so there's little quizzes on here, right? And it'll tell you whether or not you got the answer correct or not, et cetera. So I'm going to actually skip back to one of the other modules as well. Show you some of the, some of the other features that we have in here. Loading the content. So again, here we have another video with learning objectives. This one is talking about defining nanotechnology. We have photos and definitions coming in here. A little explanation about sizes of nanomaterials, where our course designers helped us to put together these diagrams and things like that to help illustrate all of this for the students who may not be as familiar with it. Highlighting parts in here, top-down synthesis, bottom-down synthesis, et cetera. All right. So we're really excited about the way the course has come out. But I also wanted to quickly share some other screenshots from the online labs that are in progress. So let me do that real quick. So screen sharing again. So this is from the online laboratory that is targeted towards teaching students how to safely evaluate materials by using things like glove boxes, et cetera. So these are just some visuals from what the laboratory would look like on your screen as you go through it. I also have a short video of, this is in progress, so it's a little bumpy, of what the student would see when they're doing the online lab and how they would get instructions on what to do with the lab, how they would go through the process and interact with the various items in the lab, et cetera. I'm going to put this one on pause here. And then this is similar to the diagram that Dr. Tsai was showing earlier, but this is from our bioaerosol lab, which part of the lab is interesting because what's going on behind here is that it's showing an algorithm that the students creating this lab are working on in order to randomly generate what bioaerosols would look like in the lab. So every time you do the lab, you'd get a randomly generated set of biological compounds, in this case, on this petri dish right here. So it's going through the different parameters that are going on beneath the surface of doing that. Right. So I'm going to share my PowerPoint again here. With a few last slides. So we do have a couple next steps to work on. We're working on the remaining two online courses, but we have to complete them and integrate the online laboratories within those online courses. And we're going to continue to work on promoting and conducting more professional development opportunities, basically as many as we can fit in and put into this process. And so the online course, like I said, is available to anyone and free. If you want to sign up to get access to it as a student, you can use the QR code that I have on the slide, or the link down here will also get you to the Purdue online website where you would register to be a student, and then you can sign up for the online course. And if you have a registration on Purdue online, you would be able to then sign up for the second two courses that we're working on as they become available. All right, and so again, I want to acknowledge the funding from the Superfund program as well as Purdue Online, whose help was really invaluable with setting up that online course, and also Purdue Envision, which is an organization from Purdue University who really specializes in developing these online laboratories and virtual reality laboratories. So the work we're doing is our faculty with the content knowledge work with Purdue Envision, who have the systems knowledge of how to generate these online labs and virtual reality laboratories. And so I've listed a handful of the faculty from all the universities we're working with who have contributed to the program so far. Hopefully I haven't missed too many people, but I'm sure we will be adding to this list in the future. So that's been one of the pleasures of this, is working with so many different really intelligent people on this project. All right, and that was all I had from the presentation.
Thank you so much, Ellen. That was really great, especially the walking us through all the really great modules that you have. And so obviously there's been some excitement from our Q&A about asking about how can users sign up to access this training. So thank you for providing that information. So, and yes, please include questions for Ellen in the Q&A. And I guess I'll go ahead and just maybe start while others are thinking about what to ask. So maybe a little bit more about how are you encouraging individuals to complete these online courses?
Yeah, that's a really good one. So we're approaching that in several different ways. So we are including, we're going to include information about how to complete the online courses with any professional development courses that we're doing. We have circulated the information among the professional organizations that we're working with. And each university that's a partner is taking a slightly different approach to encouraging students to take them. So with the University of Toledo, they're including portions of the course as required elements for one of their existing classes. So their students in the class are also registering to do the online course as a component of their existing in-person class. And what we're doing here at Purdue is we've created a separate independent study credit mechanism, basically, where students can take an independent study. They would take it with myself because I'm running the program, but then they would sign up to complete the online course. And then they would get we've established this as being equivalent to one course credit for working through it, and if all the portions of it are fully completed. So Another way to access it is as it's freely available. We've been encouraging any faculty to say, incorporate any one of the modules or a couple of the modules within existing courses as they wish. So they could assign a homework assignment as going through one of the modules that might be more relevant to a class they have or not. So this is the advertisement and encouragement of people to take the class is in progress. So if there are any other good suggestions out there, I'd love to hear them.
Well, one suggestion, we'll be sure to share this information with our SRP trainees in general. So, we have this large group of SRP, whether or not they're supported through the P42s or the R01s, but also the R25 program. And so I'm happy to share this after, and maybe we'll just share the webinar so that they can watch and they can learn from all the wonderful things you all are doing. And again, I just encourage anybody to put questions in the Q&A, but I guess I'll ask one more question. So tell us a little bit then about some of the most challenging aspects of trying to develop these online either laboratories or courses. They don't look trivial.
I think the biggest challenge with creating the courses and the labs is thinking about approaching how you create educational content differently. Because, as I mentioned, we're really trying to make these interactive, and that's not the way most faculty members are used to creating material. So, coordinating, and especially since we're working with so many different faculty, coordinating with all of them and helping them understand that we're trying to create an online course that's different than what they would usually put into their in-person classes has been a challenge, but I think it's been really rewarding overall to see what we've been able to come up with.
Great, thank you so much. We have not received any additional questions. And so I think what we'll go ahead and do, maybe just for the sake of time, I think I'm just going to go ahead and start closing us out. So thank you, Ellen, so much. I also wanted to thank all of our speakers. We definitely encourage you to register for the other webinars, where you'll not only hear from our R25 grant recipients, but you're also going to hear from colleagues at NIOSH as well as our NIEHS Worker Training and Education Program. So now I'm going to turn back over to Dylan Williams, and he's going to close us out for our webinar. But Dylan.
Yes, thank you so much, Daniel. Okay, so before we conclude, let's take a look back at the seminar homepage. This website will be active from today on and contains important resources such as links to download our presentation materials, contact information for today's speakers, and a link to our feedback form that we consider filling out, once you're able, just so that we can, take in those comments as we continue to improve the content and delivery mechanisms for this webinar series. And you can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. And that link was shared in the chat earlier in the session, but again, was also emailed to you. Here are a variety of links to learn more about the Superfund Research Program. I encourage you to check out the various components of the website to learn more about the program and the initiative. I would also like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any other webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the cluin.org website. You can also subscribe to the monthly newsletter Tech Direct. We also encourage you to visit the SRP Progress in Research webpage and check out our monthly research briefs and subscribe to the Progress in Research listserv for information about upcoming sessions. You can also follow SRP on X, formerly Twitter, at the handle before you. And lastly, I would like to encourage everyone to join us for the next two sessions in this webinar series on May 3rd, as well as May 17th. If you are unable to attend live, an archive will also be available shortly following the event. And with that, it is time to conclude today's session. Thank you all for your participation, and thank you to our presenters, as well as our moderator, for the time spent preparing and sharing their presentations with us today.